AccessCast, an Accessibe initiative, presents Unstoppable Mindset, the podcast where inclusion, diversity, and the unexpected meet. Hi, I'm Michael Hinkson, Chief Vision Officer for Accessibe and the author of the number one New York Times best-selling book, Thunderdog, the story of a blind man, his guide dog, and the triumph of trust. Thanks for joining me on my podcast as we explore our own blinding fears of inclusion, unacceptance, and our resistance to change. We will discover the idea that no matter the situation or the people we encounter, our own fears and prejudices often are our strongest barriers to moving forward. The Unstoppable Mindset podcast is sponsored by Accessibe, that's AccessibE. Visit www.accessibe.com to learn how you can make your website accessible for persons with disabilities and to help make the internet fully inclusive by the year 2025. Glad you dropped by. We're happy to meet you and to have you here with us. Welcome once again to, yes, that's right, Unstoppable Mindset, where inclusion, diversity, and the unexpected meet. Today, we get to meet and talk with an award-winning international author. I don't know whether she writes about internationals, whatever they are, but we'll find out. Anyway, Diane Floyd Boehm, welcome to Unstoppable Mindset. How are you?
Very well, thank you. International because I've lived in several countries and have traveled a lot, and so the books are sold in different countries, and I'm really proud of that.
Oh, cool. Do you publish them yourself or do you have a publisher?
Actually, I'm very blessed. I have two publishers, OC Publishing out of Canada and Texas Sister Press, obviously out of Texas. So how lucky is that? It took a long time to get here.
That is as good as it gets. Do the publishers war with each other? Do they care?
They are very kind to one another.
So oh, good.
Yeah.
That is blessed. How many books have you written?
I have 9 books and I have 2 more coming out, one in the August, late summer, and then in October, the second book.
Well, cool. Well, we'll get to more of that, but why don't we start with the usual things that it's fun to hear about, and that is you growing up and so on. So where did you grow up and do you have siblings or anything like that or any of that sort of stuff that you'd like to tell us?
Sure. I love talking about my family. So I was born in Tulsa, Oklahoma, but as the saying goes, we got to Texas as fast as we could. No, actually, Oklahoma is a lovely state. But mom and daddy, job-wise, daddy ended up in Houston. And so we moved to Texas, and I grew up in Deer Park, Texas, and later on I became Miss Deer Park, and so that was pretty cool. 1977, and it's a wonderful city to grow up in, and I have 5 siblings, which gives me lots of insight to having 5 brothers and having a feel for what boys might say, especially when they were dating. And what else? Mom and daddy, best parents ever one could ask for. Hardworking. I mean, we didn't get everything we wanted because, you know, they have 6 mouths to feed, but that's how you learn to appreciate life. You know, you start babysitting if you want something, or, you know, you get a job at 16 so that you learn the value of the dollar. And I really appreciated all that.
So how did you get to be Miss Deer Park? How did that work out?
It wasn't like I was trying to do those things, meaning contests, but a neighbor that I used to babysit for, Mrs. Bedford, she said she was going to be starting the Miss San Jacinto, which is a college out here or out there because I moved. And would I like to be in it? And I was like, no, because I'm not pretty. And then when she said, well, they're going to have a talent show and you can win scholarships for college. And then my ears perked up because I wanted to go to college. And when I found out that you would develop interview skills and things that could help you for the future. I latched on to that and tried to enter as many college-based contests that I could, and I won a few, and I lost them even more. But that's how you learn. You need to lose so you learn and improve. And developing those interview skills has helped me all through my life so far, and hence look where I'm at.
There you go. Where do you live now, by the way? You said you moved.
Yes. So, I mean, I've lived in a lot of places, but we've raised our children in Austin, Texas.
Ah, okay.
So I'm in the Hill Country and I love it.
So are you in Austin?
Yes. Well, I'm in the Hills section in Travis County where the hills start to begin. So it's the beginning of the Hill Country. So it's really, really pretty.
I haven't been in touch for a couple of years, but have you ever eaten at a restaurant in Austin called the Blind Goat?
You know, people are talking about that one, and I have not, but I am going to make a point to do that.
Christine Ha, who started that restaurant, was the winner on MasterChef in 2011. She is blind. She's the only blind person, to my knowledge, who has ever won that. She beat out, I think, something like 18,000 people to do it.
Wow.
And so I haven't corresponded with her for a while, but if you get a chance, I'd love to hear what you think of it, since you're closer than we are.
I will make a point to do that. Thank you for telling me, and kudos for her. She must be an excellent chef, but to beat out that many people is extraordinary. And it shows you that when you want something, you don't let anything stop you.
Exactly right. So one girl and five brothers, that must have been a lot of fun.
It was a blast. And, you know, I feel very grateful to grown up in the time period that I did. I had two older brothers and then three younger. So I had, you know, siblings that I got to change their diapers and stuff because they were much younger than me. So they were my dollies. But it's a great learning experience. And it also made sure that I wasn't boy crazy because I really know what boys were all about.
And I'll bet they kind of monitored you too, the older ones especially.
Oh my gosh, do I have stories for you? It wasn't until I didn't really date that much, especially in high school. And I always thought it was because I was so ugly, because my brothers would always be telling me I was fat and ugly. And of course I believed them because they were family, right? And I was one of these girls that, you know, just like people said that, then it must be true. So then my brother Danny told me about 4 years ago. He said, you know, Diane, you know how you didn't really date that much in high school? And I said, yeah. And he goes, well, I have a confession to make. I told the boys if they even looked at you that I would punch them. Uh-huh. So there you go.
Well, there you are. And so your husband had a gauntlet to go through, huh?
Oh, well, that is a funny story, too, because all my brothers were fantastic at sports, and some of them became coaches in the neighborhood and so forth, and or else they were also a coach for schools. And so along comes my husband, and you say, you know, what sport do you play? And of course, he's like, oh, I go fishing, and I'm a third degree black belt, and I do, you know, a bunch of stuff. And they're thinking, okay, that's not football, and it's not basketball, and it's not baseball. So he's not going to make it in the family. And so they didn't pay attention to him anymore. And so he just kind of slid right in, but they love him. So what can I say? He's really smart.
Well, so that worked out okay. Well, that's a good thing. Well, so did you mostly just grow up in Texas, or did you, when did you start to travel abroad? I guess is probably a better way to put the question.
Sure. Yes, I grew up in Texas. And actually, when my husband became a diplomat, our first year of marriage was in Virginia. And it was I'd always gone to Oklahoma because that's where my daddy family was, and on my mom's side, they had already moved to Texas. And so that was my only experience really of being out of Texas. So when we moved to Virginia, it was very different for me. And I remember calling my dad and just checking in, as you know, kids do with their parents, especially on Sundays. And daddy, so my nickname was Shug with him, for short for sugar. And he said, "So Shug, how are things going?" And I'm like, "Daddy, you won't believe this place. It must be like living in a foreign country. Do you know they make you pay for parking just to see your doctor?" So anyway, I think that was funny.
Yeah.
My daddy was like, "Oh, you poor thing."
Well, you think it was bad there? You should have been in New York, but go ahead.
But it was my husband, as I said, being a diplomat, that took us to be able to see the world. And we lived in the Philippines for 3 years and, you know, traveled a lot of places there, which I dearly loved. And I loved the Filipino people. And then fast forward, he became a lawyer in Texas, and that's where we raised our kids. And then one day he received a phone call, "How would you like to move to Dubai?" So we moved to Dubai and lived there 14 years. And that allowed me to travel quite a bit in Europe and Africa and parts of Asia. So I feel very blessed.
What prompted the move to Dubai? What was the reason that they called him and wanted him to do that? Because he wasn't a diplomat then, was he? Or
no, he wasn't. But the law firm that he's working for at the time, Fulbright and Jaworski, wanted to open up a firm there. So they purchased one, and then they opened up a new firm in Saudi Arabia. And my husband became part of that whole cool experience. Yeah, it was awesome.
So what was it like living in the Philippines and like living in Dubai and like living in Virginia as opposed to living in Texas?
It's an eye opener.
It really is.
Yeah.
But it is fun to live in various parts. It is fun to live in various parts of the United States. I've had the pleasure of spending years in Massachusetts and in New Jersey. And then during a project that I worked on in the mid to late 1970s, I spent time in Iowa and New York and Colorado. So I've had, and as a speaker, I've had the opportunity to travel all over the country. And it is wonderful just to see all the different kinds of experiences.
I love our country. I absolutely love the United States. And every state is so beautiful, and there's something so positive to say about each state. And I think as an American, and it's important for us to get to know the different states, because each state has things that they do that are so important that help each one of us. And so I can't say enough. I've been in all the states except for Hawaii. I really need to go to Hawaii. And then I need to spend a little bit more time in Wisconsin. I haven't spent enough time there. But also living in the Philippines, in answer to your question, wow, what beautiful people they are. I just love the Philippines. I love the people. I was able to teach school there, as well as be one of the first Americans in the National Theater there, and be in several of their musicals. And then in Dubai, how lucky to be able to be in the Middle East, get to know the people, understand the customs, and meet people from all over the world. I think there's like 172 different nationalities in that country, all working beautifully together. And so I can't say enough about Dubai as well, and the opportunities it gave me to travel.
So when you were overseas, and then of course, when you moved back, what did you do? So your husband was diplomating and lawyering, and what did you do?
Excellent question. Before we left, my background is education. I was a teacher, and was one of there were several of us teachers who knew how to turn on a computer, and a lot of people didn't. And so we helped launch bringing computers in the classroom, discovering what software would work with different subjects for curriculum. And then I started training teachers in computers. So by the time that happened, I was traveling quite a bit around the country in the schools, which gave me a real feel for different states. And then I had to reinvent myself when we moved to Dubai. And that allowed me to do something I always wanted to be able to do, which was humanitarian work. And so that led me to Africa, where I spent a lot of time in Ethiopia, Uganda, and Kenya. So how exciting is that, right?
Right. Well, when you say humanitarian work, what did you do?
I mostly was in the orphanages helping and learning how the orphanages worked and finding out ways that I could, I and people who were with me could assist in helping the orphans have food and clothing and so forth. In Kenya and Uganda, I was predominantly in the schools. In a couple of the schools, I helped do some projects where we helped provide shoes, gathered shoes, took them there. It was a whole process. And in another school, I ran a project where we helped girls. If you can imagine, some girls were 14 and 15 and they never owned a bra. I still get embarrassed when I say things, you know, I'm modest. And that was an exciting process. Another time we ran a project where we provided dresses for the girls to have, church dresses. And then for the boys, we provided some slacks. Actually, for them, they would be more long shorts. And they were made out of pillowcases. And my quilting group made all the dresses or skirts and pants. So that was really exciting. And I had a team helping me and also bringing them to the schools. So it was exciting.
In all of your travels, what was maybe the most scariest thing you ever had to encounter?
Gee whiz, I'd have to think. You know, we were with people who really understood the country, and we were always with people that were our guides. And so I actually never was afraid of anything. So, and we went way out into the barrios. I think the only time I might have was afraid when my husband decided that he wanted to take our Datsun and head for this volcano that had not erupted in many, many years. And then he decided to take a back street, and this back street was not a street, and we were driving through the jungle, and I didn't know if we were ever going to get out. So that was an experience with my husband. So,
but you never really encountered bad people or kind of difficult things like that in any of your travels?
No, I was very lucky.
Well, so you traveled, mm-hmm. you came back. And when you came back from Dubai, did you go back to teaching? Did you do more humanitarian work or what?
Well, before I left, I was already working on, I've always been a storyteller. And I had decided I really wanted to take my stories and put them to print. And so I was in that process. So when I was over in Dubai, I really worked hard to figure out how to make things happen and started also taking art lessons so that maybe I could do simple illustrations for some of the books that I now have published. And so when I came back, I became published in Dubai, actually. But when I came back home, I really concentrated on writing even more books and learning this whole skill of how to be an author and the craftsmanship and so forth. And that's where I'm at. I do go to the schools as an invited author. And I like, when I'm in schools with kiddos, even all the way up to 12th grade, I'm in my element because I have an opportunity to let each one of them know to love themselves, believe in themselves, and go after it. And if I can walk away and made a difference in their life, then I'm very, very excited.
So nowadays, do you write full time?
Pretty much. If I'm not writing, I'm in the garden, or my dog, I should say my husband's and my dog. he's a cow dog and he's a rescue. And I can tell it was my son's wife's family who found him. And they actually have a small ranch. And Remy was used to having days where he could ride around and get out to the cows. So he gets really, or she gets very excited if she gets to go on a drive. So besides walking her, she gets her daily dose of riding in the car and she gets very excited.
Well, that's important, you know.
Yeah, I like to keep my, I love my dog. She's amazing. In fact, she's just sitting right outside waiting, like, what are you going to do next?
Yeah. Don't I get to be part of the interview?
Yeah. She'd start licking the screen.
So you started writing and you said you actually got published in Dubai. What kind of a book was it that you got published in Dubai?
It was Harry the Camel, a children's book, and OC Publishing out of Canada took it on, and that was very exciting. I wanted to write a book about a camel, and I'd been wanting to do it for some time. And so they published that, and then they published right away from when I was in Dubai, the series. It's a series now, The Little Girl in the Moon. And that's morphed into the Moonling Adventures. So, yay!
So, how many books have you had published altogether now?
Nine.
And what kind of book? What kind of books are they primarily?
The majority are children's books, and then I have my very first young adult historical fiction based on my grandma. It's right here, Ruby, Rise, A Girl's Struggle for More, and that's my grandmother on the cover. And my books are about believing in yourselves, imagination, being kind to others, even if they're different. And in the case of Rise, A Girl's Struggle for More, that particular book is to inspire people to go after your dreams. So if a girl born in 1904, where life is so, so different for young men and young women, then and she can make her dream come true, which was to be a businesswoman at the time, which was not, you know, very common, especially down south, if I could say that. And at least in her area, I should qualify that. Then you can do that too. And that's really important to me. When schools are as big as they are, especially in high school, it's in junior high, it's easy to get lost. And I want kids to know that they are special, and whatever your dream is, just stay focused and be persistent. I mean, if I can do it, I feel like you can too. And I always tell the kids, look, I grew up in a small house compared to today's homes. You can imagine, you know, six kids, a mom and dad and one bathroom. but it's not about how much you have or how little you have. It's about what, if you really want something, let's map out a goal and figure out how to make it happen.
Good advice. And, you know, we often just allow ourselves to be diverted, or we tend to think, oh, we can't do something. And how do we change that mindset with people? Obviously, you're contributing to that by writing the books that you're writing, but in general, how do we get people to recognize that probably they can do a lot more than they think they could?
Yeah, that's really true. And I really believe that the first thing we can do is to be a good listener. So love yourself, but be a good listener. And if we could all become a better listener, and not really want to jump in and say, okay, you've had your say, now listen to me because I really know the answers, right? That's not being a good listener, because if you're a good listener, then you're going to be learning and figuring out how to work together. And if you have a goal of something you're wanting to do and someone's trying to help you map those goals out, be opened to listening so that you can design the best way to make that happen. At least that's my 2 cents worth.
One thing that came to mind is just what's going on in our country today, where no one is listening. The politicians in general aren't listening to most everyone else, and the politicians aren't listening to each other. We've lost the art of conversation and discussion and finding solutions together, it seems to me, don't you think?
Yes, I try really hard not to discuss politics very much.
Right.
On what you're speaking of, I can feel a little comfortable. You know, my daddy, I remember when I was young, we would be at the dinner table and daddy would say, this is not a good sign that people are putting out how they're going to vote, the signs in the yard. And one of my brothers would be saying, well, why is that? And he goes, because it would start infighting. And I think he was right. And then he said, oh, zip codes, that's not good. And, you know, I'd go, why, daddy? And he goes, because people are going to think their zip code and where they live is better. It's dividing us. And then all of a sudden he was like, I don't want to fill out these circles. And we're like, well, what circles? And he's like, we're all Americans. I'm just going to scratch this out and say, we're all Americans, you know? And I think, you know, learning these little bit of wisdoms of knowing how things changed over time that has led us to where we are today, that I wish I could get politicians to take some listening courses to learn how to listen again and not be looking for the soundbite that's going to be the great soundbite to have on the news. It's not about soundbites. It's about running this country. It's about working together and seeing all of us as one and how we can make that happen. And so you have to be able to figure out compromises, and the art of compromise, I'm afraid sometimes is not happening, but I don't have a magic wand to make everybody happy. But if I did, I would.
Yeah, well, that's, and what you're talking about is the point of my question, which is it's all about conversation and it's all about listening. Mm-hmm. We've lost the art of conversation. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of reasons that we can probably point to as to why that's occurred. But the bottom line is that we've become very undisciplined when it comes to talking with each other. And there's no reason that we should be in that kind of position. There's also no reason that we shouldn't be able to ask why a lot more. And of course, the answer to that in part is why not? So we need to really get back to finding ways to interact with each other. And I don't know whether I totally go along with the zip code idea, because we have a postal system and we have to deliver mail to people. And so it's all about sorting. And as we grew, we needed to create something different. But I think it's a discipline of how we deal with some of the changes that we've made so that we don't lose that conversational process. In companies, so many times the bosses know all the answers and don't listen to workers anymore. And we see a lot of that when we have discussions about business, that people don't recognize that when they hire people, there is a lot of expertise that comes with hiring people. And there's also a divergence of opinions. The most important thing is to get the opinions, to get all the data, and then synthesize it in an objective way. And we just tend to lose that skill nowadays.
I could not agree with you more. And I even agree with you on the zip codes. But would you like to run for president? That would be really nice.
Oh, that would be an interesting job.
Yeah, it's a tough one, isn't it?
It is a tough one.
You know, I remember on Sundays, Mom and Daddy, like to listen to some of the political shows. And of course, my husband and I always did. And I remember Tip O'Neill was really good about sitting down and speaking with Kennedy. And I thought, gee whiz, why can't we have more of that today?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it would be nice.
Well, going back to your books, you had mentioned something about you have a specific type font that you use in some of the books.
A specific
font.
Oh, yes. Font. Thank you for remembering that. So sweet of you. Yes. So it's called the dyslexia font. And once I discovered this font, now I'm putting all my books in that font. It allows everyone to be able to read my books. And what I really love about it is that it's an empowering book, but in so many ways. So kids who have dyslexia, which one of my nieces has, when they go into the library, they don't have to go to a special section of books that are just for them. Now they can be like everybody and find the books and go, oh my gosh, I can actually read this. And that to me is very empowering and very exciting.
Have you done anything to make your books accessible to people who don't necessarily read print or read print well?
I need to do that. No, I haven't. You know, it's very expensive to be a hybrid publisher. That's or hybrid author. And so what that means is I have a publisher, but I also help invest in the publishing. And so the cost can add up quite a bit. So I still need to go for that audio books. And I wouldn't mind having my books done in Braille as well, because that would be really good.
One place to get books converted to a usable form, a readable form by people who are, if you will, individuals with print disabilities, is there's an organization called Bookshare.org. Bookshare is an organization that will take files and convert them to electronic media. They can be converted to Braille, but people can just plain download them as well. Now, obviously, if there are a lot of illustrations, the trick is to put in descriptions of the illustrations. But for the print parts and so on, it is an easy way to get access to the to those books for people who don't read print. And the point is that the copyright laws allow allow books to be converted for people who are not going to read print. And the only people who can check books out or download books from Bookshare are people who are registered and who have print disabilities. So it's a protected way. So the author doesn't lose their ability to create an income stream and so on, other than Bookshare makes the books available for people. So it's something to look at. But the publishers should really be looking at that as well, because they should want your books to be inclusive, I would think.
Absolutely. And even if they didn't, the mere fact that you told me about it makes me want to do that, because I think that especially my messages that I have are for everyone. And I also think that being able to do something like that is giving back to the world. And I'm a total believer in that. And I am so grateful for you for telling me about Bookshare.
It's definitely something to look at. Well, tell me about the Little Girl in the Moon and the Moonling series.
Sure, adventures. I'll be happy to. So my tagline is embrace your imagination. And the Moonling series definitely does that. So the little girl in the moon lives on the moon. And she is a moonling, just like you and I are earthlings. And you have an opportunity to discover what moonlings look like in The Little Girl on the Moon, the first book. The next one is The Little Girl on the Moon and The Big Idea. And that book is really for everybody, because it's all about making kind wishes come true. And the book, how a little kid will read it, it'll be totally different how an adult reads it. So I like to say it has a lot of layering. And I truly love that book. And then it morphed into the Moonling Adventures. And my youngest daughter is the illustrator for that. And in the Moonling Adventures, we bring in the little boy in the moon, and both the little girl and the little boy's moon, each one of their doggies. And they take us on adventures through going to the observatory and on the moon. And they experience in a simulator, just like we would do back home on Earth, and they visit different parts. So the first one was Kenya. I'll let you in for a secret because no one else knows it, but you get to know about it and all your audience. And that is my daughter's working on the Moonling Adventures, birds around the world. And so I'm very excited about that one. And
that'd be a sequel.
Yes. So we'll have several. And the purpose of these books is the Moonling Adventures, again, is how much we are alike than different. So they live in Tycho Town, and Tycho is the largest crater on the moon that we can see from here on Earth. And so I build in ways that science and teachers can use this for curriculum, but also, again, trying to show how much, no matter where we are in the world, how we love different animals, how we enjoy different birds. And so find these similarities that connect us so that we can have moments to just have peace and tranquility, because we're all humans and we share this globe together. And so that's really the purpose of the whole Moonling Adventures.
So this whole thing with the Moonling Adventures is fascinating, except how do they survive up there without an atmosphere on the moon?
Let's get technical here. Excellent question. So I actually have one where you meet Moxie, the little girl on the moon's doggy, and you go on a tour of Tycho Town, and you discover that as you go inside the crater, that there's this huge bubble, and this big bubble allows them to be able to breathe inside their town. And then also they have a fake gravity going on, because their scientists are so smart, they can figure all that out. But when they're on the actual surface of the moon, then just like our astronauts, even the doggies have special shoes that keep them grounded. And so that's how I worked it all out. And I even have a whole backstory of all that one day it'll come out in another book.
Well, the only problem with living on the moon, it's my discomfort with living on the moon, is without an atmosphere, they must get bombarded by a whole lot more meteors than we get hit with.
Yes.
Those rocks come from anywhere.
That's true. But to enter Tycho Town, you actually have to press this one little rock that's on the surface, and you enter this inside the cavity of the moon. And so it's a whole new world, because it's your imagination.
Well, sure. Well, there's nothing wrong with that. It's just that you do have to deal with the meteors and all that. And, you know,
if you're inside.
Not if you're inside. No, that I understand, but it's being on the outside. And of course, if the meteors hit the bubble, does that get noisy? So there's another question for you to explore.
I will have to explore that.
Have to think
Thank
about
you
that.
Thank you so much. I will.
Aren't I such a big help?
I love it, because you're getting my imagination going. But I also have this book called A Song of Peace. And it's about a little boy named Tommy, and he just wants peace on Earth. And there's a twist to it at the end, because a lot of books are written about peace. So I have a fun, unique little twist to it. And it just won a couple of awards. And so I'm very proud of it. And right now, with everything going on, one thing we could do is everybody take a deep breath and just say the word peace over and over and over and put it out there.
Which goes back to what we talked about earlier with conversations and listening.
Yes, it sure does.
What kind of research, or how do you do research for your books? I'm assuming just by listening to you that a lot of thought and research goes into what you do.
Thank you. So with the children's books, they come to me and I'm inspired. When it comes to the Moonling Adventures, yes, I do a lot of research. I needed to really study birds and where they fly and when they're migrating and where they migrate, so I can show and teach the unity. So for example, the Dover bird, it is in Dubai, but it also flies to several other countries, migrates into the United States, into South America, and parts of Europe. And that makes it fun because, again, it shows commonalities between the countries. In I always like to say Ruby because it was about my grandma, but in Rise, A Girl's Struggle for More, oh my stars, I can't even begin to tell you how much more admiration I have for historical fiction writers, because years of studying goes into making sure you have the voice right for that time period, that you actually have the facts correct about the settings and so forth. And I actually wish I could wake my grandma up from heaven and say, "Grandma, you had a lot of other things you should have told me." It was because the 1920s is fascinating.
Oh, it is. And we talk about how in our world we've advanced so much and so on, but we forget a lot of the lessons that we could learn from before we, and I put the term in quotes, advanced so far.
Yes, you're absolutely right. And we repeat so many things. And so if we could just take a deep breath, especially you politicians, and listen to people who have lived a little longer and learned from that and learned from mistakes in history so that we don't repeat it, would be quite lovely, right?
So do you hear a lot from other authors and readers and so on? How do you interact with them? And they must give you ideas and things to think about as well.
Thank you for the question. So I've joined several author groups and I am always learning from them. And I appreciate so much from seasoned authors because, again, I was an excellent classroom teacher and I want to be an excellent author. And the only way to do that is to learn from the seasoned authors. So I really appreciate it. And I have a publicist now. Like, I didn't even know that authors could have publicists. And so actually that's how I met you. So kudos to my publisher,
Mickey
Mickelson. And he is teaching me a lot as well. I am a young author in the sense of having things published. And so I have a huge learning curve. But that's okay, because that means when I'm out there, especially with students, they get a kick out of me saying, "I'm on a learning curve too, so let's learn together."
Tell us about some of your speaking trips to classes and so on. What has that been like?
It depends on what country I'm in, because that really makes a difference in the culture and how you dress and so forth. So if I was in Saudi Arabia, then, I wear a abaya. And I always believe that no matter what country you're in, you respect and follow their laws and their rules. And I had the opportunity, and I feel very blessed, to be at a British school several times in Saudi Arabia. I spent a whole week there and was with kiddos from elementary up through middle school. And not only was I in their classrooms, had opportunities to teach some of them privately creative writing, read their writings, have one-on-one conversations, but also the principals at each school were incredible. They gave time off. I don't know how they figured it out, but where I would have all the teachers in the auditorium and they could pick my brains. And that was really exciting. And as a matter of fact, a couple of them are now published authors because of their experience there. So I feel very lucky. In America, I've been in many classrooms. And of course, since I understand the American system, I can, you know, I'm like, you know, it's like, yay, I understand everything going on. What is it that you want me to do? What is the outcome? Because I don't do a canned presentation. I want to hear, what is it you want the takeaway to be? And when I hear what that takeaway is, then I design the program for them. I have them go over it to make sure it is exactly what they want. And then we go from there. So it could be from working with young children all the way up to so far it's been ninth grade, and where we've done creative writing projects together.
Good for you. It's really, I think, important to not do canned speeches. I was talking with someone else about this recently, and I think that the best speakers are speakers who learn about their audiences and who are even capable during a speech of, when necessary, making a course correction or whatever to make sure that we're connecting with the audience and engaging the audience. And so, as I put it, I love to talk with audiences. I never like to talk to an audience, no matter their age.
I love that phrase, speaking with, not to. Absolutely. And besides, you get energy from that because you know they're listening and engaging in what you're saying. And so when they ask you a question, you're like, oh, I didn't even really think of that. But your brain gives you an answer. It's very exciting. I actually walk away full of energy.
That's really a good point, that when you open opportunities for questions, you never know what kind of questions you're going to get, especially with little kids. Oh, and yeah. I learn more from answering questions, especially from kids, because they're not shy, generally speaking, and they're very curious. And it's fun to have real conversations, and they tend to respect you more when you're conversing with them, not just lecturing. Absolutely. Even when you're answering a question, if you lecture as opposed to talking with, they know the difference.
Absolutely. I just recently, because of COVID, there was no in-person, but now some of the schools are opening up, and I was at this beautiful girls' school, and the young girls had very direct questions. And sometimes instead of just answering the question directly, I would give examples of my own childhood because I wanted them to understand that I actually knew and understood what it was like to be a little girl or to be a preteen. And then from there, answer the question, and the smiles that went on their faces with the question, because they knew I was really trying hard for them to know I understand. Did that make sense?
Yeah, they knew you got it because you remember living it yourself.
Mm-hmm. And when people see you as an adult, sometimes they can't, even your own children, imagine you little. Like, what? You were little? Are you kidding me? I thought you couldn't relate to the world.
You know, and from my perspective as a speaker, I'm not happy unless I go away from an event learning more than I'm able to impart. And I can tell when that happens. When I get great engaging questions, when I get an opportunity to interact before and after the event and all the things that occur, it is so much fun to be able to have lots of takeaways as a speaker. So it's sharing knowledge and information, not just imparting knowledge and information.
Oh, you are so right. Sharing. And then you're so excited and jittery that, you know, you just like, oh, I need a Diet Coke. And Coca-Cola didn't pay me to say that.
Yeah. Well, I understand. Time for something new. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, what's on the horizon book-wise? I know you talked about one sequel coming up, but what's next in terms of projects and so on for you?
Sure. So I am working on the sequel to Rise, A Girl's Struggle for More. It'll be a good while before that's out because I've just now finished the research. And so I've mapped out how it's going to go, at least.
Is that going to be on the moon? Will that be on the moon again?
No, this is a young adult historical fiction. The moon one, I just shared the Moonling Adventure, Birds Around the World. In August, I have coming out A Time to Fly, and I'm super charged about that one. It's all about a little birdie who doesn't want to leave his nest, and his mama helps him get the courage to fly. And I think that is something that will every person can relate to, even as adults, remembering there was a time that we were afraid to open that door. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I'm really excited about that. And then in October, it's Charlie and the Tire Swing. And that's been on the back burner for some time. So I'm so excited it made it through up to the top list for the publisher to say it's time to do that one. And that'll morph into Charlie and the Tire Swing Adventures. So, but this first one is all about how Charlie got the tire swing. And I'm really, really, both of them, I'm just thrilled about, and they each have a different space in my heart for what they share and do.
What's your favorite character that you've created or that has invaded your psyche that has come out in books?
Oh, gosh, that's really tough because I love all my characters. They're all so special. But I would say, oh, goodness, I love Harry the camel because he's all about, he didn't like himself. And you learn all the reasons why. But in the end, he discovers there's nothing better than being who you are. And so Harry has a real special place in my heart because I want young people of all ages to know that they're important and they should love themselves. And I say should, but I want them to feel in their heart to love themselves, because once you love yourself, you can accomplish things. And so I guess if I had to say someone, it would be Harry.
Mm. Well, you said that you had just finished research for which book?
Rise, A Girl's Struggle for More. It'll be version 2. It doesn't have a title yet. So I'm excited about that because it's based on my grandma's life. As I said earlier, it's continuing on to show once you're in the workforce, what it was like for the women in the 1920s, but it's set in such a way, it takes place in Chicago. And it's a real eye opener for what life was like. Everyone always just thinks, I shouldn't say everyone, but most people think the 1920s was all about the Charleston and so forth. But there was more to that. And you actually start discovering, and there's a real parallel to us right now, too, in our time world, because you're starting to see the little tiny cracks that lead to hunger and people losing their jobs because they don't have the money to go and purchase different things. So I think it'll be a good learning experience on lots of levels and a fun read.
And of course, in the scheme of life in Chicago and the rest of the country in 1929, we had the stock market crash, which led to the Depression, which is, of course, a continuation of what can probably be a very fascinating story, how to get through all of that.
That's true. Luckily for me, it will end before that happens, but yeah. It'll lead right up to that. And, you know, I wish I would have been a better student in high school because I truly find history so fascinating and I appreciate it so much more.
Lots of research left for you to do.
Yeah, so much research.
Well, so in your downtime, you garden, you say, and you have a cattle dog and that keeps you busy. What other kinds of things do you do?
I enjoy singing And when I was in Dubai, I was in Popular Productions, which is a part of the West End. So I was in musicals, and I hope to get back to that again because I do love singing. And I started taking piano lessons. Uh-huh. And I don't know, I just love doing everything. Since it's summertime now, I go outside and go swimming in our pool. And mostly I just like to look at the clouds and sing.
Well, what kind of advice would you give to somebody who's interested in possibly being an author or who wants to take up this kind of work?
Sure. Write. You don't have to be published. Just know right now, the moment you write something down, you are published because you've written it. Find a space or your favorite couch, favorite chair, even if it's just you just have one room, find one space that you want to say, that's my holy ground. That's where imagination's going to come. And just write whatever comes to you. Maybe it's like, oh, I love zebras today. Just write different things down and then just start creating stories. Your first stories are not going to be your best, but the stories that just keep coming and coming will end up being, you'll just become better and better. And when time is right, you'll know when it's time to go for it. And you're so lucky today because there's so many ways that you can be an independent author. Blurb, for example, allows you to design your whole book, get it going. There's a lot of different places like that, but just believe you can do it and it will happen.
And that's as good as it gets. And it's great advice. And we have to start somewhere, right? And the fact is, I think all of us have stories and we should tell the stories.
Absolutely. We are all storytellers. The moment someone says, how was your day? And you go, oh my gosh, it was horrible. You should have seen what happened today. Or
it's a story.
It was such a lovely day. I met so-and-so. It's a story and it's to be told. And even if the first thing you write about are the stories from your childhood, those stories can be morphed into other stories. And so we are storytellers. You are absolutely right.
If people want to reach out to you and get a hold of you, how would they do that?
Sure. So the easiest way is just to go to my website, DianeFloydBame.com. Now I'm going to spell it because it's Please. Different. It's D for dog, I, A, N as in Nancy, N, F, L, O, Y, D. B as in boy, OEHM.com, DianeFloydBame.com. It looks like Diane Floyd Boheme, but we pronounce it Bame.
That's all right. My screen reader pronounces it Boehm, so there you go.
Yeah, it's my husband's name. I adopted it when I got married.
Well, I figured it was something like that, and then I spelled it, but I'm glad that you pronounced it. So DianeFloydBame.com, and people can reach out and read things there, and they can contact you and so on as well?
Yes, they may. And they can sign up for my newsletter. And all my books are on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and you can order them through your local bookstores.
Well, and sometime we'll have to talk about how accessible your website is and how to fix that, which is, of course, one of the things that I get to do being part of this company, Accessibee, but that's another story.
I definitely want to talk to you about that. That would be awesome.
Easy to do. So we will do that.
Yes,
well,
sir.
I want to thank everyone for joining us today. I hope that you enjoyed our time with Diane and that you will reach out to her. As I always say, you are welcome to reach out to me. I'd love to know what you think. You can reach me at michaelhi@accessibee.com. And that's michaelhi@accessibee.com. Or you can go to our podcast page, which is www.michaelhingson.com/podcast. And Michael Hingson is MichaelHingson, just like it sounds even. So yeah, unlike Bame.
Yeah, correct.
But I hope that you will reach out. Love to hear from you. Love your thoughts. If you'd like to be a guest, please reach out and let us know. if you know people who you think ought to be guests on our podcast, we'd love to hear from you about them or hear from them. Feel free to let us know about them as well. And of course, when you listen to this, please give us a 5-star rating. We appreciate your comments and ratings and suggestions and take them all to heart. So Diane, once again, thanks very much for joining us on Unstoppable Mindset.
It was my pleasure and honor. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Unstoppable Mindset podcast. Thanks for dropping by. I hope that you'll join us again next week and in future weeks for upcoming episodes. To subscribe to our podcast and to learn about upcoming episodes, please visit www.michaelhingson.com/podcast. Michael Hingson is spelled MichaelHingson. While you're on the site, please use the form there to recommend people who we ought to interview in upcoming editions of the show. And also, we ask you and urge you to invite your friends to join us in the future. If you know of anyone or any organization needing a speaker for an event, please email me at speaker@michaelhingson.com. I appreciate it very much. To learn more about the concept of blinded by fear, please visit www.michaelhingson.com/blinded by fear. And while you're there, feel free to pick up a copy of my free ebook entitled Blinded by Fear. The Unstoppable Mindset podcast is provided by AccessCast, an initiative of Accessibility, and is sponsored by Accessibility. Please visit www.accessibility.com. Accessibility is spelled A-C-C-E-S-S-I-B-E. There you can learn all about how you can make your website inclusive for all persons with disabilities and how you can help make the internet fully inclusive by 2025. Thanks again for listening. Please come back and visit us again next week.